Right, so this is what I'd like to think of as the European lunch slot. So it is a director's blackboard lunch, a bit later than the usual time. But so if I was asked by Don to give a talk, a very low-level type of talk on black string instabilities. So what, that's the reason for the frivolous title. And in a sense, this is meant to be a follow-up to Rob Meyer's blackboard lunch of a few weeks back. And the reason, I guess, why Don asked me to talk about black string instabilities was because it was work of myself and Raymond Laflamme of about 12 years ago, where we actually pointed out that a lot of the brain solutions that had been written down in the context of string theory were actually unstable. Although in some sense, it's slightly surreal giving this, because it seems like an awful lot of the follow-up work or some really interesting topics that people are looking into has actually been done by the people in this program, but not so much by myself. So I decided to take this concept of director's lunch seriously and instead try and think, well, how are you going to justify what we do to people from the other programs? So how can we try and convince people doing gamma ray bursts or supersolids that these things are interesting to look at? So I have an uncle who's a minister or trained ministers, and so I've learned that like any good sermon, you have to have three main points. It also helps to be short, so maybe this will be a short talk. Or maybe that's my personal bias coming in, of having had to sit through too many of his. So the outline, therefore, of the talk is going to be what, why, and how. Shortened to the point. So in other words, first of all, rather than motivating at first, just start by saying what black strings are. The middle bit will be more about motivation. Why are these interesting to look at? I mean, all of us on the program think they're interesting to look at, but can we just step back and think, well, how are you going to motivate this for someone who doesn't work in the field? And then finally, just a little bit about how, what the instability is, and what it might imply. Okay, so let's start with what. So gravity is an important force. It may not be the strongest force, but it's definitely an important one. It's what keeps us where we are. It's the reason we exist. So I decided I just couldn't possibly compete with Rob's absolutely masterful talk of all these dates. You know, I just simply can't keep that many timelines in my mind at once. So I decided instead to go for more of a low level, less detailed, more broad brush stroke view. So all matter gravitates, and as far as most people are concerned, all matter gravitates attractively. So ordinary matter is attractive. Now, I don't really want to get into a detailed discussion of who indeed was the first to talk about a black hole, but the folklore that I seem to remember was, I think it was Laplace in the late 18th century, who conjectured, well, if we've got enough matter together, then eventually it's going to be, the gravitational attraction is going to be so strong that light can't escape. So I noticed the super solid people kept talking about freshman physics on Monday, so I decided to go one step further and do high school physics and to say that you get, if you try and say, what is the escape velocity, you set your kinetic energy with your speed of light and put it equal to gravitational potential energy, then you see that you have a critical size for your Newtonian gravitating object. R is 2gm on c squared. And I guess it's annoying, if you like, having gone through the whole business of learning about manifolds or general relativity, to come up with exactly the same answer. So this is true however you look at it. So why is it crucial? Well, the big difference between Newtonian gravity, or the Newtonian point of view, and general relativity is that when Laplace or whoever was thinking about black holes, they knew that time was absolute. So even if light was trapped, that didn't really matter. It wasn't in any sense a loss of information. Whereas thanks to Einstein, we know better. And if light cannot escape, then nothing else can, because nothing can travel faster than light. And so now I'm going to move to general relativity, but I'm actually going to set myself a challenge. I'm going to give this talk without once writing down a metric, because I figured, I was told by Don, the most successful blackboard talk is one in which nothing was written on the blackboard. I'm not sure I can achieve, well, I know I can't achieve that. It's already shown that, but what I would like to do is to do a talk without a metric. So anybody who's been to my talks will know that this is a real challenge for me. So this is my challenge. This talk must have no ps squared in it, okay? So you're going to have to keep me on the straight and narrow here. So general relativity tells us that instead of our absolute time and space, we have this one entity, space-time, in which, you know, all the features of what we know of and experience as space and time are simply part of one object. And if we want to have gravity in it, that object is curved. So we know that it's part of something we call a manifold, which is simply a technical name that brings along with it a whole lot of constructs that we can use to try and encode what we mean by black holes, and indeed tells us how we can analyze things such as instabilities. So instead of writing down a metric, I'm going to draw things. And if you've been to displays on gravity, you've probably played with these models that they have, where you can represent a gravitational field simply by some sort of curved surface. The star depresses, like having a rubber sheet, you put a mass down on it, the star depresses it, and if you try and roll pennies or balls around it, they will be curved. And that is exactly how we view space-time. It's a pretty good model for space-time. And this thing that I'm not allowing myself to write down is simply saying how distances and local angles are measured. And that is the basic observable of relativity. So we could say it's distances, or it would be light rays and clocks. Oops, I'll take that to mean the same thing. So that is what what gravity is about. It's all about how long does it take to do something, how far is it between two different places, what's an angle between two different things that you're looking at. And so in this picture, the black hole is simply when the star gets so massive it just disappears from view. So again, we find, or I sort of thought about this, thinking from the point of view of somebody looking at gamma ray bursts, that we have very different points of view on what a black hole is. So when we think of black holes, we think of something extremely idealized. It's a very clean object. It's a beautiful mathematical construction. It's empty space that curves and has this event horizon in it. And even what we mean by an event horizon is a mathematical definition. Yet, in astrophysics, in the real world, black holes are very different. We think of them instead, when we know that they're out there, and instead they're extremely energetic objects. They're associated with extremely high energy physics. Black holes have accretion disks. These are very messy. All the gases are being attracted into the black hole. There's a lot of collisions, very messy physics, shooting out a lot of X-rays. And it's just completely different from this mathematical black hole. Even what we mean by a black hole is not, I'm sure, exactly the same thing. Because in astrophysics, we can't wait till future time like infinity to figure out where an event horizon is. We simply know there's a black hole there because we look and it's small and it's massive and nothing seems to come out apart from all this, these X-rays coming from the particles being absorbed by the black hole. So they're two very different objects, but without the understanding that we obtain by looking at the idealized picture, we wouldn't have a starting point. Or people looking at black holes in astrophysics wouldn't have a starting point to actually make predictions. So I guess our program is looking at this nice, clean, ideal world, not messy black holes. So what we do is we want to try and understand theoretical properties. And therefore, we want to do calculations. So we have to set up a framework in which we can define things. So what do we know about black holes? Well, our nice clean black holes have got very little information associated with them. They have a mass, they can have a charge, and they can have angular momentum. And that's it. So in other words, they're very bland. Again, if we define them mathematically, there are a few other things we know about them, some of which are relevant to the later discussions. So we know that event horizons aren't supposed to split. If we define them suitably. We also know that under very mild assumptions, we have a singularity inside the horizon. And again, provided energy is positive, area always increases. And then there's something we suspect, and again I'm sort of picking out things that are related to a black string instability point of view. There's also this rather interesting idea of cosmic censorship, which is that singularities are hidden. If you have to paraphrase it, singularities are hidden behind the event horizon. Okay, so that's the story of these nice ideal classical black holes. If we add in quantum field theory, then as we all know, black holes can radiate. Nature abhors a vacuum. So again, I made sure I looked up my factors, because I'm not very good with factors. I wanted to just again remind ourselves what sort of the orders of magnitude we are that we're talking about here, that the temperature of a stellar-sized black hole is about 10 to the minus 8 Kelvin, and of course this Schwarzschild radius, the size of the black hole, is of order a kilometer. So these temperatures are absolutely tiny and not really of any relevance for astrophysical black holes. But again, what we know from quantum black holes is that they obey laws of thermodynamics. And since I'm ignoring charge and angular momentum, trying to keep things just as simple as can be, because the black holes have a temperature, we also associate an entropy with them. And once again, this entropy is huge. If we add in the H bar, it's on the bottom. So, but the important point that I'm going to need for the discussion of black strings is simply that entropy is proportional to area. So this is what we know about black holes, traditionally. What we've learned by looking at them mathematically is we've got an intuition about how black holes ought to behave. We think of the event horizon a bit like a membrane with a tension. And this tension is called the surface gravity. And so the bigger the black hole, the smaller the surface gravity. And that's kind of coming into this idea that very big black holes, these types of thermodynamics, or at least the radiation and the quantum effects, are relatively unimportant. Whereas for very small black holes, is this thing move? Yeah. Oh, okay. Obviously, I don't have the knack. Thank you. So I think one thing that's nice is to notice that this comment I made about the mathematical definition of horizons and saying that they don't split also has a corresponding entropy type of justification. So if I look at a black hole of mass m, then its entropy, which is proportional to the horizon area, is proportional to the mass squared. So if I were to try and split that black hole in two, then each of these separate black holes would have entropy a quarter m squared. So over here, the total entropy would be m squared over 2. So you would say, well, that means two black holes can merge, but they can't split. So although this other argument is derived using statements about infinity, if you try and think hole in a slightly more muddy sense and just think of it as being some hole in space which you can get some idea about locally and associate an entropy with that which is proportional to the area, you're still going to come to the same conclusion, that the total entropy of the two black hole system is lower. The intuition of the event horizon as a membrane also tells us that the horizons would want to be spherical. And that's also correct. So there is a sense in which we've got to the point about 10 or 15, no, 15 years ago, where we felt we understood black holes. There was this very concrete sense here. These were really somehow very physical objects, you know, that you could see locally, and they behaved in a way that made sense. You could use your intuition. So why can't we have a string and the simple reason in four dimensions is that in order to have a string, gravity has got to be able to reach out in two spatial dimensions to pull the light in. So again, if I was going to explain this by drawing pictures, because I was trying to think, you know, somebody from a different program who didn't really think about general relativity very much, then you would say, well, gravity is quadrupole in nature. So if you try and draw what a gravity wave does, it tends to distort objects around a specific polarization. So roughly speaking, you need two dimensions to be able to draw your quadrupole, and then it's got to travel in a third dimension. So that's a very waffly argument as to why you need three space dimensions at least. So there's no way in vacuum that gravity can pull out, reach out, and pluck the light rays in and keep them confined. But of course, if you allow yourself to be in more than four dimensions, then the story is different. And so what we do in five dimensions is we take the standard black hole, the Schwarzschild black hole, and we just translate it. We spread it out into another dimension. So that's the what. What is a black string? We've gone through what we know in normal four-dimensional physics about black holes, gravitational physics, gone over what we know about them, and said, okay, if we add an extra dimension, we can get a string. Next is why. This is where I'm just going to take a sort of complete general excursion and try and think of all the reasons why. You know, why the heck should we even take extra dimensions seriously? And if we do, why should we even be thinking about things like these strings? Because as far as most people are concerned, three dimensions is good enough. You know, if it was good enough for my father, it's good enough for me. And so why look at these things? And so for this bit, I'm definitely not going to sort of be focusing too much on what we're actually doing in this program. I want to just go, this is obviously going to be a very personal point of view on why look at extra dimensions, but to sort of start it off, there's basically two ways of looking at extra dimensions. And the first one is the standard one of Kaluza and Klein, 80 odd years old, which is, and I come to my prop, basically that. So you take an extra dimension and wrap it up so small that you can't see it. So I couldn't do this in England. We don't have coffee stirrers for some reason. But anyway. So this is, if you look at it head on, you can see it's a tiny circle, but to all intents and purposes, this is linear. This is just a line, a string, in fact. So for Kaluza and Klein, you can have extra dimensions. You don't see them because they're small. So that's in a nutshell. But you can see their effect, and of course I have to do this without writing down a metric, so. So they do give, over and above gravity, Kaluza-Klein theory, this little set of stirrers, does give some extra observables. First of all, you've got the scalar, and that is the size of the circle. And then the other thing that you can do with this circle is you can take your four-dimensional space, add on the extra space, and you can either do that in a nice orthogonal way, or you can do some sort of boost. And so that is a vector, which of course was why Kaluza and Klein were interested in this in the first place. Because it enabled a geometric way of realizing electromagnetism. So you could unify gravity with electromagnetism by essentially taking the gauge group of electromagnetism and making it physical or real, a geometric quantity. Of course, the scale is a problem, but nonetheless, the idea of Kaluza-Klein theory has persisted. So why do we take extra dimensions seriously? And I think there's really just one word for that, which is superstrings. I think without, well, I suppose maybe some supergravity dieharders, but without superstrings, I think we wouldn't really be taking extra dimensions all that seriously. But since we're being told that we live in either 10 or 11 dimensions, then we need to think carefully about what's happening to those extra dimensions. Again, why bother? I'm at Durham, so Carlos Frenk is also at Durham. I don't know how many of you know the cosmology community well enough, but Carlos has always said, but Ruth, we know how the universe is. You know, why? Why do you bother? We know it. We've got all the answers, right? But the fact of the matter is that cosmologists have only got the answers by assuming some initial data. So, while cosmologists might be sort of working themselves out of a job there, nonetheless, they do need initial conditions. And so it's in this goal to try and understand why the universe starts out the way it does, without resorting to anthropic arguments, that really drives, I think, a lot of people who think about early universe cosmology. And of course, if we're doing early universe cosmology, then that's very high energy physics. So, whereas the supersolids people were saying how cheap they were, because these experiments are at such a high energy, they would be so expensive that in fact we are very cheap, because of course we can't do experiments. We can only do them in our mind. So there are all sorts of other reasons to try and take these extra dimensions seriously. We have ADS-CFT, or this idea that somehow classical gravity in one dimension up can actually tell us about gauge theories on the boundary of a space. And again, I know absolutely nothing about this, and I don't really want to get in deep water here. But this is, again, another motivator for studying gravity in more than four dimensions. One which I'm more familiar with is something called brain worlds. So I said there were two ways of getting extra dimensions and not seeing them. The first, which is the traditional way, is Kaluza-Klein theory. But the other way of having extra dimensions and not seeing them is the idea behind brain worlds. So brain worlds allow us to have large or even infinite extra dimensions while not really doing that much to the physics around us. So it's worth just reminding ourselves of how we get to this situation. An easy way to motivate brain worlds is to actually think about defects, vacuum defects, where we have two distinct vacuum phases, A and B, now, normally you'd say, well, okay, we live in the vacuum, so it doesn't really matter if there's more than one vacuum phase, but because I'm always thinking of things in terms of the universe, and therefore cosmology and evolution of the universe, we have evolved from a state which was at very high energy. Therefore, it is possible that the universe has gone into different vacuum states in different regions. Between those regions, you're going to have boundaries, and those boundaries, like domain walls, in this particular example, and inside you have a different phase from your vacuum outside. And so physics inside the wall is different to the vacuum state. And in particular, it's possible that you can get actual trapping of particles on your defect, your brain. So, for example, you might have a fermion which is massive in the vacuum states on the outside, but massless inside this particular wall. And so effectively what it does is that fermion lives in one dimension down. So it gives the picture of a brain world, as simply a slice through something with more dimensions, where standard physics, particle physics, is confined to this brain, but in this bit, which we call the bulk, we've got gravity, and only gravity or possibly a few extra fields can propagate. So that's the picture of a brain. And it's sort of completely the opposite in many ways from Kaluza-Klein theory. In Kaluza-Klein theory, your extra dimension is very small, everything's averaged over the extra dimension and you don't see it. In brain worlds, everything's possibly big, and instead of averaging things over this extra dimension, you often have very strong space-time effects in the bulk. So that sketch is something which corresponds to a particular brain world model. Called Randall syndrome, which is very, very calculationally explicit. So you could, like any toy model, it's not necessarily corresponding to something which is motivated by higher energy physics, although spaces which are similar do crop up in string theory. But the most important part about this particular setup is that it's explicit and you can do calculations in it. So it's very, very useful for developing intuition. And the thing for our discussion that it's important to point out, since I'm meant to be talking about gravity, is that in spite of this very weird setup, having some slice where we're confined, where flatlanders living on the brain, what we see, gravity, is that it is in fact Einstein gravity on, as far as we are concerned, plus small corrections. One and R cubed correction. So we have this picture that gravity is essentially as we expect. It's familiar, it has some corrections, but at a small scale, the scale of the curvature, this warping in the space as you move away from the brain. So why have these brain worlds become so popular? To a large extent, this is actually thanks to phenomenology. And it's because of the realization that when you have extra dimensions, what this means is that gravity can seep out into the extra dimensions, thereby weakening itself relative to ordinary standard model physics. So it gives away of actually explaining why there is this huge hierarchy of scales between standard model physics and gravitational physics. So I think although a lot of the original models that try to resolve the hierarchy problem are not necessarily still currently considered to be viable, I think that was why brain worlds had this explosion of interest recently. And as far as the story about black strings is concerned, what they do is give us a way, first of all, of actually saying you can have big extra dimensions without messing things up in terms of our standard four-dimensional physics, and also because it brings things like black holes or possibly black strings or other black brains into, maybe, so almost into the into experimental range, because if you are weakening gravity by letting it seep out into the extra dimensions, if in reality the scale of gravity is closer to the standard model scale, then maybe you can start getting all sorts of gravitational effects in accelerators. I'm not sure I entirely buy into this, but I do know that people at my home institute, the Phenomenology Institute, have at least been consulted by some people who are genuinely worried that by switching on the LHC, they'll destroy the Earth by producing a black hole. So maybe they're being slightly irreverent, but nonetheless. So, and again, this is in the context of toy models, but a lot of the intuition developed in the context of these toy models is now cropping up again in some of the later string theory models. And I just couldn't help but draw this because I think it's just such a... it's almost a daft diagram, but... So whereas in string theory, people used to compactify on a very small six-dimensional space, now the idea is that maybe you can distort this six-dimensional space, and we live on a brain, this is us, right at the end of some strongly warped space. So this kind of does it all. You can get inflation from moving brains. You can get hierarchy from warping. And I guess it's, although sort of a lot of people call this the bicycle seat picture, I don't know, when I drew it more recently, I decided perhaps it looked more like General Grievous, which if you haven't got kids of the appropriate age, may not mean anything to you, but I rather like that analogy myself. So. So what I wanted to get across really in that section of why was the idea that although what we're doing in this program is looking at very specific and very idealized problems, that these very specific and abstract problems are the way you make progress, the way you find your intuition, which you can then take forward into new arenas. So, for example, doing brain worlds in this particular rather simplistic toy model has got across a lot of ideas which are now being picked up in more complicated scenarios. So just to finish up, the how. So as Rob said in his talk, to a large extent, when people were looking at higher dimensional black holes, it wasn't like there was a huge outcry of excitement and interest when these solutions were being written down and studied, at least not initially. So Rob himself, with Malcolm Perry, wrote down black hole solutions in higher dimensions, but sort of holes, the equivalent of a hole in four dimension. Then there's fairly a sort of full monty paper by Gibbons and Maeda, which I think was to my point, if I had to recommend, I would say that that's a sort of easier one to follow, where the idea of now the general black hole solutions and black brain solutions in more than four dimensions were worked out. So Gary here, together with Andrew, was interested in the sort of gravitating objects you could get in string theory, and they basically went through and worked out every possible type of brain solution. And this, if you like, was the sort of status of what was going on for higher dimensional. Very simple, I'm being a bit streamlined here, but of solutions in higher dimensional gravity. So because you now have these extra dimensions, you can stretch your black hole out along the extra dimensions. And so you have a whole plethora of solutions. You can have solutions which are like holes, like strings, like membranes, etc., etc. And so the generic term is just brains. So where Raymond and I came in was that actually a bit before, I think, before the work of Horowitz and Strominger, we've been thinking about cosmic strings. So again, in the 80s, they weren't just superstrings. People were also interested in cosmic strings. And we were thinking about cosmic strings in more than four dimensions, because perhaps there was a phase of the early universe where you had some sort of large extra dimension. So we were looking at cosmic strings in five dimensions. And the only obvious solution there was this: take a normal black hole and translate it in the fifth dimension. And so what we wanted to do was simply look at what happened to that object gravitationally. And at that point, we followed the work of Reggie and Wheeler and were unable to find that anything strange happened, except that there was a sort of technicality in our analysis, which meant that the space of solutions that we were looking at for perturbations around this black string was not self-adjoint. We'd somehow lost on a certain range of parameters two of the linearly independent solutions. So why might you expect something to go wrong with these things? Well, there were two reasons for being suspicious about this solution as a cosmic string. The first is it's not boost invariant along its axis. If you do Lorentz transformations, you change the solution. And that's not what you expect from a cosmic string. And the other one is one of these good old entropy arguments. So the entropy of one of these strings is going to be proportional to its area. So that's m squared L. Whereas, if I were to take that same amount of mass contained in a string of length L, so I'm comparing now string of length L to a black hole, roughly speaking of mass ML, you have to be a bit careful here, but it essentially works, then the entropy of the black hole, which is now proportional to the horizon length cubed, is actually proportional to ML to the 3/2, because the mass is proportional to this horizon scale squared. And we find that if L is of order the mass, that so for L bigger than the mass, the entropy of the black hole is bigger than the entropy of the string. So the technicality about this showing this instability worked involved the fact of basically a choice of initial data surface. So what in the paper that Raymond and I wrote 12 years ago, what we actually, when we corrected this initial oversight, so let's see, simple analysis. And so in order to resolve the technicality, and this was something which was achieved when in the 1970s, it was actually not till the 1970s that standard Schwarzschild black holes were proven to be stable by Viswanathan, is that you have to be careful what you choose for your initial data surface for perturbations. And that is that this initial has to touch the real horizon of the black hole. And by that I mean what's called the future event horizon. So if you have black holes forming through gravitational collapse, the structure of the black hole is extremely definite. It only has a horizon to the future. And that's where this initial data surface has to touch. And as soon as you realize that, and you write down now your perturbation theory on this particular data surface, you actually don't pick up this problem, and you find the full set, the full basis of eigenfunctions, and you see that in fact, for a range of frequencies, it corresponds very closely with your understanding for entropy. You do get an unstable mode, and it's precisely for wavelengths longer than of order this GM. And what does this mode do? Well, if you look, and this is where I say horizon in a very loose sense. So if you actually look at what happens, you're doing perturbations in general relativity, so that's perturbations of space-time, which means perturbations of distances. And so you see that the effect on this distance is that at some points it shifts. If you look in, the horizon corresponds to the zero of some particular function representing distances, you see that the horizon actually shifts. And tends to ripple. So that's what, without writing down a metric, the instability is and what it does. And I think it opens up a whole can of worms, if you like, or a whole set of interesting questions, which are what happens, of course. I think this is one of the things that, you know, quite a few people here have certainly done a lot more on than I have. And the answer to what happens, I think, is a really interesting question. I mean, on the one hand, Gary Horovitz has proven a theorem which says that the horizon can't fragment, at least not in finite time. And yet numerical work seems to indicate exactly the opposite. For myself, I just don't see how, if you have a very skinny string like that, so if you have quite a long length of your extra dimension, I just don't see how you can get something sensible that is anything other than an actual black hole. However, I sometimes wonder whether it's what we actually mean by the black hole that's the issue here, whether we're applying, you know, the abstractions or theorems that we're using are in somehow in violation of the intuition that we've developed of this thing as being somehow a localized or quasi-local object. So I think this is a really interesting and still open question. Another thing which has come out of this, I mean, I think Raymond and I did realize that you could possibly get crinkly brains, crinkly strings, but there was no obvious way of actually deciding what these would be. Again, this is something that people have participated in this program have looked at numerically and perturbatively. And it does seem you can get these non-uniform strings, which again opens up all sorts of questions of how you're going to, how to specify, how to categorize black holes or gravitating solutions. Do you have uniqueness? Or can you get uniqueness by defining extra parameters? And I think the discussions on tension I found particularly interesting during this workshop. So another thing which personally I find intriguing about black holes or understanding these particular instabilities, what Raymond and I did was in vacuum. These, if you look at black holes on these brains or in these warped spaces, you can show, again, you have a instability of strings. And so this means if you want to construct black holes in these brain worlds, you do actually have to consider something localized. And that feeds into understanding about quantum black holes. If the physics on the brain really is somehow quantum corrective gravity, then understanding about black holes on the brain will tell us about quantum corrected black holes. Roberto would say there's no such thing as a static non-singular black hole on the brain, but then again, you know, there's numerical results that seem to counteract that. So there's all sorts of interesting questions which we're looking at in our program, and I'll finish there.
Concerning your argument about why you wouldn't expect anything to spill to black holes, if you allow negative energy, then you can have
okay, now I was approaching this very much from the point of view of saying, you know, that matter is not exotic, from the point of view of the people of astrophysics, saying that matter is ordinary, matter's, you know, what... with... Oh, right. Why? Well, I was trying to there just say, well, what is a gravity wave, and why would you need three dimensions to have a gravity wave, and it was only meant to be a... I'm not sure I see why that is... Yeah, I think my tongue was firmly in cheek. Yeah. Well, I'm not even convinced. I mean, apart from... Yeah. Well, I mean, apart from, for the record, I don't think these things will turn up. I think there's also... I'm not sure whether people have really sort of thought about this also, not just in the context of a very... How much has been done in terms of non-idealized collisions? So, you know, with the fact that if you try and dump these things together, these energies, that there'll be a huge, you know, that the mass won't be contained, that there's going to be a lot of energy loss. I mean, I think that a lot of the estimates are actually... I know. I mean, I just sort of get the feeling that there's a lot of other messier stuff that's going to be going on there, you know, than just like very simplistic. But I mean, that's definitely not my. Well, I think we'd have seen them in astrophysical processes first, I'm pretty sure. You know, I think in a supernova you'd almost certainly pick this up.
Yeah.